Welcome back to The Continent of Resistance, a podcast on labor movements across Asia, and our special series on the striking decade. Set against the backdrop of the 2008 financial crisis and its significant impacts on export sectors in Asia, workers in Cambodia, Indonesia, Vietnam, and China rose in unprecedented numbers, demanding fair wages, better conditions, and stronger protections. This is a high point in the wave of workers' strikes and mobilizations that swept across Asia during the late 2000s and early 2010s. This episode examines how workers adapted their strategies, sometimes scaling up localized protests into larger movements or general strikes. Despite diverse political and economic contexts, these labor movements reveal a common thread of resilience and growth as workers gained experience and confidence while confronting mounting global pressures.
One of the reasons that motivated us to really look at and scrutinize this period of workers' struggles in Asia is the fact that there have been a wave of industrial workers' strikes and mobilizations in the late 2000s and early 2010s. Across a large number of countries in Asia, there were significant mobilizations and general strikes in Indonesia, in Cambodia, as well as strike waves in China and Vietnam. And in this episode, we want to understand some of the reasons behind the fact that there were all these waves of strike across the region within a 4 or 5 year period. Why do we see this common upsurge? But also, what are some of the differences in the way the movement mobilized across different countries? So maybe we can start with Cambodia, where there was a massive wave of worker mobilizations.
The general strike that happened around the end of 2013 and until early 2014 was a continuation of protest and labor unrest that actually started beginning 2010, you know, around September 2010. Thousands of workers took to the street and protested the minimum wage that was announced by the labor advisory committee. And you know, that issue of minimum wage was central because it was also the minimum wage that was decided by the central body, you know, that triggered the general strike again in 2013, right? And I think we could tie all of this back to the argument that we actually laid out in episode 2 about the integration or global integration of Cambodia's economy and garment sector, in particular to the global market, right? In 2005, actually, there was a removal of export quota from Cambodia to the EU. And, you know, one of the key facts that we should know is during the 2000s, a decade, export of garments and textile from Cambodia to the global economy was, you know, 90%, right? Like between 75 to 90% over the decades. And for that amount of export that goes outside, it means that the economy relies so much on the demands from the outside, right? And the removal of the quotas, that was part of the process of facing in Cambodia into the global economy and not relying on protections from the tariff quotas put a lot of pressure on the capital, on the employer side. And that expressed or that pressure, you know, articulated for workers as a form of, you know, low wages or suppression of wages or, you know, an attempt from the employers to hire and fire workers more easily, right? So yeah, that was the background.
I think this point about the deepening of integration into the global economy is really, really important and relevant. It makes all those countries much, much more dependent also on export production for the economic growth, right? It's a huge source of taxations and employment, but it also makes them very susceptible to the fluctuations in the consumer market in the global north, in the US, in Europe. So when the global financial crisis hit in 2007, 2008, it has a very immediate knock-on effect on the economies of those countries, and then by extension, the workers who work on very low wage jobs in the export sector.
Right. Just one thing I want to add here was we talked about the limitation of the labor industrial relation framework that was built upon this premises or idea that, you know, when the countries open up its market and, you know, and set put in place this labor market and invite foreign investors to come and, you know, and put a lot of workers to work in Cambodia in particular, you know, the trade agreement between Cambodia and UK and the US and EU actually were conditions on the fact that the country has to put in place a decent legal framework on labor rights or labor standards, right? But this is symptomatic of the fact that actually this premise is actually not working pretty well. You know, a lot of workers were exploited, they faced hardship, and when the access to the market, to the outside or international market was removed, and then the whole system that is based on this premise might collapse, right? And workers took to the street to say that actually, yeah, well, you know, even though the country got the access and the economy seemed to do well, then we're not doing well, right?
That's right. I think, and also reviews the lack of protections for workers. So when the fluctuations of the consumer market in the global north have a, you know, direct impact on the lives of workers in the global south. And once there is a crisis and capitalism is crisis prone region, then there has, it has an immediate impact on workers, and they lose their jobs. And then it shows that there's very little protection, right? So they really would find it difficult to survive without employment. And I think that pushed a lot of workers to the brink in the years right. following the global financial crisis.
Right, or just a little, one more thing. Well, it also, if you want to talk about how the system works well, you know, it just goes to show that worker representations in the system was insufficient, right? There was no, worker didn't have representation in the system to have a say about their wage, because it was a central body that determined the wage. And the issue here in Cambodia was the wage increase was not enough, and that is, workers saw that it was an insult, because when they announced the minimum wage, it's really low. It was not considered a livable wage for them at all. So in Cambodia, and also in Indonesia, you know, what happened in Indonesia, it's also a series of general strikes that happened in 2012 and 2013 and again 2015, where we saw millions of workers participating in the general strike to demand for basically a couple of things. One is minimum wage, you know, issues. The second one is to eradicate this fixed term of flexible labor employments that the government tried to kind of legalize. And this is the issue that is kind of unique and uniform in the region, right? After the Asian financial crisis in the late 1990s. And the last one is the social security issues that, you know, well, as you said, you know, once workers were pushed to the brink, they would also counter or push back to demand for protection, social protections for themselves.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, for Vietnam and China as well, there were already strikes waves starting in the late 2000s, and certainly around 2010 or so, there were significant strikes and that spread. And one of the probably the most talked about one in China is this wave of auto worker strikes mm-hmm. in the south. That started with an auto part factory in Guangzhou, and that spread to other auto makers in other cities and provinces. And I think what it says is two things. One is that the immediate trigger of the global financial crisis that made workers, you know, push them to the brink and made them desperate and forced them to organize. And there is also a long-term dimension to this, which is, you know, over the previous decade or more, workers and unions have been building up their capacity and been learning from their successes, victories, but also failures. So their the level of organization, their tactics and strategies have also been changing. That's why, you know, we're seeing this upsurge, not just in response to the global financial crisis, but I think it's also a result of the accumulation of, you know, years and years of experiences of organizing, of learning of tactics and strategy. And I want to ask Kyung, you about how that kind of helped with the mobilizations in Indonesia and Cambodia.
Right, yeah, especially in the case of Indonesia, where I talked to activists. I talked to one activist from Indonesia who participated and observed the general strike in the 2010s decade, who told me that, I asked him, the general strike or strike waves in the 2010s decade is quite different from the decade earlier. So what were the key differences? And he told me the 2010s waves happened without the domestic crisis that happens. And, early on in the 2000 decade, it was a result of a financial crisis in Asia, right? So that had deep impact within the country. But, in 2010 decade, workers shifted from demanding for immediate, demand or immediate responses in terms of wages and working condition to demanding for something broader. So they are, in the 2010 decade, they were mobilizing more politically. They were mobilizing for broader structural changes. But in terms of tactics that you mentioned, Kevin, I think one of the things that stand out, is that the first general strike in Indonesia happened in 2012, right? And that was one of the first general strikes that in the series. But I think the line was that in 2012, there were a lot of small-scale direct actions that workers took place. This happened particularly in one area in Bekasi, in Western Java, where workers did factory raids. Basically, they went around from factory to another factory in the industrial zones just to, as a form of direct action, to disrupt productions, right? And they demanded immediate responses in terms of changes of working condition in the factory. And they went around from places to other places, and they gained a lot of support from workers in the industrial zone. And based on this experience of winning small wins with the factory owners, and sometimes these actions were really radical, included putting manager, lock them in the factory, something like that, to get what they want. Based on these experiences and, confidence, they were able to upscale to have a general strike, which is something really encouraging, right? And after this experience, they have more confidence.
Yeah, this is really interesting because I think in contrast with Vietnam and China, we still see most of the strikes or almost all of the strikes are very localized. They are limited to specific individual workplaces, even though in some cases they do spread. So it could start with one factory, but nearby factory in the same industrial zone may take the cue and say, oh, actually, we should go on strike together. And there, from time to time, could be kind of informal coordination. But overall, the scale of the strikes tend to be much more local and localized. And I want to ask you, about the role of unions in Cambodia and Indonesia, especially in terms of helping to scale up and organize the strikes and coordinate with workers across different workplaces and regions. And of course, in the background is the democratization in those countries. So can you talk more a bit about the role of unions?
Right, in these two contexts, I think we, around the decade 2010s, general strike or strike waves, we saw apparent roles of coordinating bodies, central coordinating bodies, in Cambodia, CIKODBU is one of the unions that coordinate at the national level, and it is one of the organizations that actually supported workers to gain an increase in minimum wage in later in 2014. despite, you know, despite the tragic ending of general strike in January 2014 that led to the death of four workers and a lot of injured workers. And in Indonesia, you know, in these general strikes in 2012 and 13, there were coordinating bodies like Labor Assembly or National Coalition of Labor Movements in the case of 2013, you know, that I think is a kind of coalition that was built during this period of experimentation and upheaval. I think one of the things I want to point out is in Indonesia and Cambodia in particular, you know, this how this happened actually was also a result of, you know, workers realizing their not only agency, right, but their political roles as a part of a larger movement in this democratization process, right, which is what we actually talked about before. And, you know, workers in these two contexts were struggling to kind of insert themselves and their movements into political movements. And this is something that an ongoing process that workers still struggle with, right, to kind of demand for structural change through politics. And I want to come back to your China and Vietnam cases where, you know, you talk about continuation or learning of workers. I wonder if there's any changes that you noticed from earlier, you know, we talk about in the 90s or 2000 before and now. It seemed to me that the tactics of workers were using at the time didn't change as much, but did you see any changes in the way that workers express their demands or take action?
I think there are definitely similarities from before, continuations from before. For example, they are still mostly, or almost all of them are wildcat strikes. Even in this period, the state party-controlled union federations did not play a role in organizing workers for strike or endorse them. So those strikes remained wildcat organized by workers on their own. But there are, I think, other advances in how workers organize. We see the strikes are getting longer, at least some of the more significant or landmark strikes are getting longer. And I think that demonstrate better organization by workers, that they feel the confidence to organize a two-week or even a month-long strike. So I think that is the important difference. Another difference or change is, I think, the sophistication in how they organize themselves and their tactics, the ways to pressure management, and also their negotiating skills, I think, became more sophisticated and more nuanced. So to take that example of China, by the late 2000s, there is a better workers feel that they can actually organize better negotiation with management at the individual workplaces level. So this is when this idea of collective bargaining really caught up in China. So there were, of course, always ideas about collective bargaining, but the late 2000s and early 2010s is when Chinese workers really took that idea very seriously. And similarly, in Vietnam, workers were really demanding very structured bargaining, negotiation over wages, over conditions. And this is different from the kind of more bargaining imposed by the government to say, oh, let's have a tripartite sort of consultation process. Whereas in this period, you can see workers actually taking this seriously and say, actually, we want to be the main actor in the negotiation with our employers, not the union or not the government on our behalf. And I think one reflection on all of this is, on the one hand, I think you still have quite an increasingly militant workers' actions, sophisticated tactics, but this is in contrast with Cambodia and Indonesia, is the inability to scale it up. And I think we can talk about both the pros and cons of that. I think what it does on the one hand is it makes it difficult for workers to have a large voice in policymaking, because if they cannot organize themselves into a larger force through organization, through mass unions and mass organizations, I think that voice doesn't get expressed politically as well. But at the same time, it also means that their focus, singular focus, is to disrupt production at the point of production. So I think that remains their most powerful weapon.
Right. Yeah, I want to add to my answer earlier to your question about general strikes. In Indonesia, I think one thing that workers did was, you know, there were, I think we have to recognize two levels of coordinations, right? The general strikes were coordinated by alliance at the national level and local levels. So the local levels, the role of local levels, alliance, meaning like unions in the locals get together, the role of local alliance actually were really important in, you know, allowing workers to have a space to talk about strategies, right? Which this is something that have developed in Indonesia over time, over a longer period. You know, what we saw in the 2010s were, you know, apart from these local levels of alliance, there were national alliance that happened and helped to elevate this or leverage the power at the local to national level. And I think it is important to talk about these two levels and the significance of having of workers having this kind of safe space for them, right? While for the Cambodian case, I think the Sikadu has a different kind of strategy and theory of change, if you will. You know, they actually target the employers association, the garment manufacturers association, and the buyers from the outside by creating this triangle relationship where, you know, they know that they cannot really negotiate on a even basis with the governments, but so they use this leverage with the buyers to pressure buyers and brands for them to pressure the governments to increase the minimum wage. But by doing that, you know, you need to coordinate with workers on the local level to organize workers at grassroots level in order to, you know, be able to advocate with the buyers and brands. But coming back to the issues of advocacy, mobilizing and organizing, we talked about in the early episode, this approach is a combination of organizing and advocacy. But I would say putting a lot of weight on the high level advocacy, but at the same time, organizing workers at grassroots level to support, to build the base to support them. While in the case in Indonesia, a lot of organizing work has to happen in order to pull off the strike at that scale.
This is something I want to ask more because I think, you know, the role of the unions is hugely important and their coalitions. We, you know, in the case of Indonesia, after the end of Suharto period, you see this emergence of all sort of unions, independent unions, that also led to fragmentation because then instead of a few unions, you have, I don't know, dozens, hundreds of unions or more. So I want to ask, does that have an impact on how they coordinate? Does that actually fragment the union movement, or actually it's not as significant issue that actually workers and unions are able to coordinate at a high level to make common demands?
I think the role of the coalition or alliance structure is actually to address this fragmentation that you mentioned, right? And sometimes, you know, building coalition or alliance like this could bypass some political differences and coordinate on particular issues, right? Like they can say, oh, you know, we're going to mobilize around this issue in particular, and not people who join maybe are not going to see politics in the same way, but they could still, you know, work around particular demands together. And I think this is something that happens. While, you know, it's also important to mention that the general strike that happened in Cambodia in 2013 was participated by workers from all political spectrum. Mm-hmm. And that's because the issues of wages and the issues of flexibility, flexible employment relations just impact everyone.
Right. And I think that's a really important point about the building of unity across different unions and political spectrum. I also want to maybe, you know, spend a little bit of time talking about the results, because I think this upsurge of mobilization, strike waves, extremely impressive, demonstrate workers' power on large scale, what are the results of those mobilizations? Do they, the workers, the unions, secure their gains?
Right, yeah. I mean, in both cases, the general strikes in Indonesia in 2012 led to a big increase in minimum wage, right? And also the one in Cambodia, not in 2013, the general strike in 2013 and 2010 in Cambodia actually didn't allow workers to achieve what they wanted in the first place. But I think when we evaluate the impacts of general strike or collective action like this, I think it is important to recognize like non-tangible impacts, right? The impact on workers' consciousness or the confidence that they gain from participations. And I think the participations of workers in the general strike actually radicalized a lot of workers, right? Like in the case of Indonesia, that actually workers learned early on since the late 2000, even 2007, 2008, 2009, they started to take small actions in the locals, and that led them to be more confident to do radical things like factory raids and road blockades, and these are really effective at the local scales, right?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. What do you think?
Yeah, I think this is important to highlight. I think there, on the one hand, very often our assessment of the success or failure of a particular protest, strike, or wave is whether they get what they want. And I think that on that, it seems clear that, there are minimum wage gains. Similarly, in Vietnam and China, worker did also gain significant wages. Although in their cases, because their wages are already a lot higher than the minimum wage, so it's not so much about minimum wage gains as much as their real wages have gone up as a result of their political actions. But I think the larger point I think is really important to emphasize is the kind of intangible, the learning, right, and the radicalization, the changing of their consciousness and their testing of their skills. I think that's something, it's a basic lesson, but sometimes we forget is the labor movement doesn't progress along a linear line, right? It's not as if you start something and then it will always progress. There will be a period of defeat, there will be a period of retreat. But I think sometimes maybe even whether you win on particular action or campaign matter less than how they transform you, how they transform workers, how they shape the organizations, how they build up our skills. It's important to have that kind of longer perspective on labor movement, I think, when we assess whether, that this period of mobilization succeeded or not.
Right. I think it's quite a shame that, that the trade unions in Southeast Asia in particular, in this context, do not have strong holds at the workplace level. I mean, as we mentioned before, that the collective bargaining agreements are really, really low, have been low. And I think that to negotiate at the workplace level is a really good way to build power, right? To kind of sharpen your skills, because you negotiate regularly, you have this mechanism that is at the workplace level. I think it is a good way for workers to practice democracy as well, and to learn skills by negotiating and asking for small things, and that would lead them to asking for bigger ask, right? And sometimes workers were put in, like in our context in Cambodia or Southeast Asia, put in a high risk situation right away when they want to take action without having a trade union as one vehicle for them to learn or to practice and to kind of sharpen their skills. And I think it is maybe the one lesson for us or as activists to think about how we can support and workers to kind of learn and build skills from like low risk level and, practice democracy. And that, well, it would take a long time to kind of build power at the national or to pull off a general strike. But I think it is a work that we, you know, we have to do it little by little.
Thanks for listening to the Continent of Resistance podcast and our series on the striking decade. I hope you enjoy the conversation and don't forget to subscribe to our podcast.